All right. Let me pray as well. We'll let some other people hopefully shuffle back in here. Father God, thank you again for this day. Thank you for the opportunity to have these classes in this building and this freedom that you give us. And Lord, as we look back at these subjects and subjects in history, subjects in philosophy and subjects in theology, that they would all be what they truly are about, and that is you and your glory. So as we look at this, your servant Augustine, that we would look at this thesis, that we'd hold everything in light of Scripture, and that we would be transformed as a result of seeing this big vision. And we pray your blessing on all that we do today, for your name's sake and for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. So this is the first of 4 weeks in Augustine's book, The City of God. These 4 weeks, right in the middle of the class, we're going to cover his greatest work. And the first one is going to be called How the Pagan World Disintegrated. Just as a little bit of background, which you really need to get through the first 10 books of The City of God, so I'll give you a little bit of it. In 410 AD, an army of Goths sacked the city of Rome. And it wasn't the last time that Rome would be sacked in that century. But one of Augustine's Christian friends, a younger man by the name of Marcellinus, had been appointed by the emperor, Honorius, to oversee the continuing Catholic Donatist dispute that we talked about last week in North Africa. So Augustine had this public official for a friend. And Augustine had now been a bishop for over a decade. And as the charge that Christianity was to blame for the sack of Rome began to gather steam, Augustine wrote a letter to Marcellinus. It started out as a letter, but it became the seminal work of the Christian worldview throughout the Middle Ages. The City of God was first penned in 412, and the finishing touches were added and then published in 415. And then just like if you were with us in the Calvin's class, you remember there was an evolution of the Institutes. There was four different editions. Well, it's the same thing here. He didn't get done with the final edition until 426, the book that we have today. But the first 10 books deal with our question today, and that is, what was the real cause of the end of the classical pagan civilization? And just as a little practical side note here, application you can make as we go on, that'll be the same answer to what is the end of any secular civilization. And as long as we're throwing around the word classical, it'll be the same answer to the question, which I hope you're asking at some point, why does a merely classical education and the institutions built therein crumble after 5 or 6 years? Because it's going to be the same reason that Augustine's going to give. Or, for example, why is America going down the toilet? Well, it's going to be the same answer. So you're going to hear a lot of things today that you might think, that is very impractical. Okay, I buy that argument, but nobody believes that stuff anymore anyway, so this is impractical. Well, you'd be surprised how much of a parallel there is. Here's the 4 points that we're going to talk about today. It's on your notes, so hopefully you see this. We're going to look at the incoherent ultimate reference points, or what I call gods at odds. We're going to look at incoherent ethical norms, or what I'm going to call vicious virtues. And then thirdly, the incoherence proven by their own authors and by history. So these 3 points are Augustine's argument. He's starting at incoherent ultimate reference points. He moves on incoherent ethical norms that flow from that. And then he's going to go evidential on them. He's going to show that that incoherence is actually agreed upon by their own authors and by a tour through Roman history. And then fourthly, we're going to see that there's a gospel call of sorts throughout. And again, these are the first 10 books of 22 books in The City of God. And it becomes a model for classical apologetics. So the first point, the first answer by Augustine, is that Rome, and by that he means all of classical civilization. So you can ultimately throw in Greece here as well. Incoherent ultimate reference points, or gods at odds. The first thing you need in your worldview, and the first thing you need in a civilization, are coherent ultimate reference points. In other words, the biggest things you think exist are going to determine the character, the quality of everything else in your worldview, everything else in your life, and everything else in civilization. Book 1 answers the charge in specifics. And again, if you're not aware of the charge, which is that Christianity is to blame for the fall of civilization. And that's not an old charge that stays in the ancient world. That's a new charge that's resurrected in the Renaissance. It's resurrected with a vengeance by Voltaire. And anybody who's a modernist, in fact, the very designation Dark Ages is a thesis, is a caricature of people in the modern world to suggest that Greece and Rome took people out of the oldest Dark Ages, that man was evolving out of this animism and this collectivism of the ancient world, and that Rome and Greece would have saved us from that, but for Christianity. So you need to know a little bit about this, because this thesis lies behind, on an assumptive level, of a lot of the things you hear today. But Book 1 answers the charge in specifics. First of all, three main points Augustine makes at the beginning. First of all, the Roman citizen is reminded of the facts which are still fresh in his mind concerning the humane treatment by the barbarians of those who sought refuge either explicitly in the name of Christ, or else, in other words, pagans flocking to Christian temples and claiming to be Christians so that they'd be left alone, or those in Christian churches. And the reason why that was even happening is because the barbarians who were coming from the north had been evangelized the century before, unfortunately, by Arius and his followers who had been exiled up here. And so a lot of barbarians were Arian, but at the very least, their treatment of Christians, in many cases, especially among the Goths, was much more humane. And Augustine's point is, have you ever heard of that before? Did you guys practice this? Now, this was unheard of in times past. What pagan religion ever required or engendered such mercy in the heat of battle? Secondly, if Christian influence is to be blamed because it had forbidden the Romans to sacrifice to their gods, then you might ask what sort of gods these are to begin with. It turns out that they couldn't protect their cities, in part because they are the sort of things that need men to protect them. And so he draws that out in a lot of different ways, how they're being carried out of these cities, as they always have been throughout history, and they needed the people to protect them, and yet they're saying that Christians had disallowed us from being able to sacrifice to them, and so they've lifted their protection from us. Thirdly, the fall of Rome came from within, and it came early on, well before Jesus ever came into the world, as Cicero himself already laments four centuries earlier. And it's evidenced by the fact that even as civilization slips away, the animal passions of the people continue to drive the pagan day after day to the theaters of decadence for a final titillation. And of course, that has nothing to do with today either, right? Even as we're wasting away and the barbarians are at the gate, we go for more and more and more titillation from pop culture. Moreover, and this is going to seem a little bit more obscure, but he goes on for this, you know, for about half a dozen pages, because it was a big deal to them, and it would be a big deal to you if barbarians ever attacked, which is the norm for most people in most places throughout world history. We're just living in Disneyland, so pay attention. The critics of Christian women who were raped in the recent sieges were put to shame on the grounds that, in other words, they were being accused as well. Christians were being accused of everything at this time, even how they bore up under suffering. But on the grounds that all Romans had always held, that in the case of rape, there are two bodies but one adultery. And this maxim was made famous throughout Roman history by the story of Lucretia, a noble woman who was raped, yet while her husband and friends sought revenge, she took her own life out of shame. And the point of the story is that the soul is untainted by harm perpetrated upon the body, as purity is a matter of the heart. And in that same context, Augustine frames a pretty good argument against suicide and for the sanctifying purposes of suffering in this life. But I think one of the things worldview-wise that comes out of that is that you have to agree with Augustine's view of the soul, which is just the biblical view of the soul, in order to believe in something that you would think is as simple and easy a call as to say that only the party that committed the rape is guilty of it. If you believe in that the body is equal to the soul, or that the body is over the soul, you've got all sorts of problems. Now, that's an extreme example, but I think it's a good example of how you actually have to believe in the Christian view of the soul in order to prevent your mind from all sorts of monstrosities. And today it's the exact opposite. It's people who believe that the soul is superior to the body who are made the biggest villains in history. But that's a side note. Book 2 argues that the pagan gods have never protected men's souls, because everything that was wrong with Rome had always been wrong with Rome. And he cites the comments of their own authors to make the point, principally Cicero, who writes just before the coming of Christ. So I've got a roster there of some who. You know, I'll be honest with you, when I first read The City of God in 1998, I was 22 years old, I did some fast-forwarding in the first 10 books. Because I had no background in Roman history, I'm going through this list of the gods, I kind of heard these names a little bit here and there. Punic Wars, okay, that happened in the ancient world at some time. And, of course, I knew who the philosophers were. But besides that, after the first 12 pages, I kind of did some fast-forwarding. And you might do the same because what we're talking about today is some obscure stuff. If you don't have an idea of when on a timeline, if you don't have an idea of who, and if you don't see the map, the where, and visually what's going on, the side that probably wouldn't have been the most popular part of the City of God in its day, because it's more current events, to you might be the most boring part, and you want to get onto the stuff in the next 3 weeks, which is the actual thesis of the City of God. But a little bit of background will help. Cicero was one of these philosophers writing at the very end of the Republic, so right about here-ish, as the death of the Republic was right there. Julius Caesar was making his march to come in and set himself up as dictator. And Cicero is one of these statesmen that believes in an eternal law and believes in having popular representation, but among an excellent class of people who are looking at eternal things. He was very much like what Plato would have been if he was a statesman, a politician. And he writes about extensively about the decay of Roman society all the way from its beginning and how it didn't hold on to the Republic. Because in Cicero's mind, the chief characteristic of a civilization rising or falling was whether or not its men could look at the law as an actual object, as an invisible, eternal object of the mind. And anything else is to be judged in light of that. And so he would criticize popular arts and democracy and people that don't think like that and prove it, voting, shouldn't be allowed to vote, because he judged everything in light of some eternal law that is unchanging. But he talked about all this happening, all of it ending before the coming of Christ. And it's an unanswerable case for people that are familiar with those things. And so Augustine was counting on his audience being learned. And most interestingly, he points to Virgil, who offered himself as the Roman answer to Homer, so a century later, when after Julius Caesar had taken power, and he gives the empire to Octavian, who becomes Augustus Caesar. Virgil is kind of Augustus's poet that's going to create in the Roman mind the origins of their glory. And he writes the Aeneid as a Roman answer to Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, making his character, Aeneas, bring glory from Troy, which had been defeated in the Trojan Wars, to the Italian peninsula. But Augustine looks at this and says, look at this, this is your founding story. What glory did Aeneas bring with him but his gods? And so Augustine breaks in and says, and ought not prudent men to have entrusted the defense, ought prudent men to have entrusted the defense of Rome to these conquered gods? So from this perspective, in their main story, Rome was made of the stuff of Troy's fallen debris. In other words, the scraps that flew off the table in Troy, that was the origin of Rome. And the idea is that Aeneas came, didn't like things in Carthage, came here, invaded there, sort of a second Trojan War, set it up there, and of course, long story short, fast forward past the Aeneid, he abandons his children, they're raised by wolves, you know, and when that happens, Romulus and Remus, Romulus kills him, and Romulus becomes the founder of the city on seven hills, which takes its name from Romulus, and that's Rome. So Augustine's point there is that this whole city was founded in bloodshed. Now, of course, this is a mythical story, but if this is what you guys want to believe, everything about it is unjust and weak. Augustine calls on them to censure the demons that really stand behind these gods by ending the sacrifices and rites to them that these same citizens had already condemned in the stage actors who portrayed them. So whenever the Romans whenever they went to the temples, they would worship these gods by the foulest sacrifices, which we'll get into in a second. But then when they went to the plays, all their plays were about these gods being the biggest losers you've ever seen in your life, the most morally degenerate things you could possibly imagine. And that was what they paid money to go see. And so Augustine is just saying, I'm just giving you back what you guys pay to see. In book 3, he does the same with the God's failure to protect men's bodies, summarizing the whole history of Rome to make the point. They cannot protect because they cannot even protect their own interests, duped at every turn by each other and by fate. And so he says, pagans should reflect whether it is really not more criminal to believe in such gods than to violate one's oath to them. The other thing I don't have on the board, just for your background, is a chart with the Greek god on the left, the Roman name he took or she took, and then the role that particular god or goddess played. Again, that's just for your, so you can get through the first 10 books of the City of God, which, as I said, if you don't have any background in Roman history or in ancient mythology, you might be scratching your head at certain points. So Augustine next attacks in book 4 the incoherence of the pagan religion itself. And here's where we're going to get a little bit philosophical. He frequently cites a guy that you probably have never heard of, I would just imagine, a guy named Marcus Varro. And he writes sort of a definitive book on all things divine and human. And he winds up going through classifying the different kind of gods and goddesses that people have worshipped, the kind that they should. And he's interesting in that respect. But he cites him a lot to point out the idea that there is actually knowledge of one god. But then in Roman history, he's quickly called Jupiter, quickly paired with a sister spouse, Juno, and then just as quickly divided into a seemingly infinity of friends and foes based upon all the diverse things in nature. So that part of the modernists' argument is not original, and it's not particularly enlightening. The idea that there is a kind of progression in the degenerate mind, they would say that it's an evolving mind. Yeah, pay attention. Animism to polytheism. Now, the modern worldview would see this then continuing to evolve into monotheism and so on. But what Augustine was saying, yeah, this is a perfectly natural progression, but it's a regression. There's the idea of one God that comes first. And you cut that off, and you're left with things down here to worship. And the easiest natural thing to do is simply to assign a supernatural power to each of these particular forces, whether they're good things or bad things or whatever. And so he's saying that that's exactly what they did. But there's two origins to the gods in Roman thinking. One on earth and one in heaven. But the bigger problem that Augustine was pointing to was this, that they had origins to begin with. Every worldview besides Christianity, whether it is ancient paganism, whether it starts in animism, or whether it's Dawkins' evolution, every single worldview besides Christianity starts with things down here, and those things down here get better. Every worldview starts with one thing called nature. And out of nature, nothing in particular causes everything, in general and particular. Every other worldview besides Christianity has this blatheringly irrational feature to it. Only Christianity has an actual cause that is a sufficient cause to explain all other motion. And so Augustine's main beef with their religion, and this is what's going to be so practical to us, is that it's irrational. You have all these finite, particular reference points that you're calling ultimate reference point, but you have no logical reason to do so. There's nothing about them that makes them supreme to everything else. And so we ask the question, what does Rome gain by worshipping parts of an ultimate thing? And what would she lose if she worshipped the one true whole God? In summary, they have set diverse gods over diverse parts of the world. And so the idea is that they knew enough to know that only omnipresence could hold together a society just as much as hold together a cosmos. But they didn't see that in one being. They wouldn't. And so they had to divide up the tasks to all these others. So you had the problem of no unity to the diversity of things. And you had the problem of no power, no causal power to hold them together or to animate them. And this is actually a good overall apologetic. If by gods you mean amplified humanity, and that's the phrase that Francis Schaeffer used and other authors who commented on Augustine. That thesis really comes from, in fact, if you read How Should We Then Live, for example, Schaeffer's book, that's the first one I read by him, he starts out talking about why Rome, why ancient civilization fell. And at the end of the day, the ultimate reason was you didn't have unity to the diversity of things down here. Nothing made sense because no thing could be held in common with other things. There was no meaning to it. There was just these disconnected particulars. And the gods he called amplified humanity because all of their traits were the traits that we see. And this is exactly what Feuerbach and Freud said Christianity takes part in as well. But even the Roman authors knew that that wasn't true. They lamented the fact that this was true about their gods. If what you mean is that these gods are personifications of each element of nature or each element of a pantheistic god, then everything that is trampled upon in a barbarian sack is a trampling on God himself. But in either case, you have no god at all. For there, Augustine says, we have accounts of their lusts, cares, and angers of the gods. Now the smartest Romans, again, suspected all this. They maintained the gods as useful illusions or noble lies for the purpose of maintaining order. That's what we do in the modern world too. George Santayana, for example, is one philosopher that's famous for that. He didn't believe that Christianity was true. He's kind of like Cicero. He didn't believe that we could really demonstrate the existence of God, but he preferred Christianity to secularism and preferred Catholicism to Protestantism precisely because it brought a physical unity. It brought a story or a narrative that made sense of things, that could make society permanent. And so a lot of the Roman philosophers were in that same boat, people like Cicero. But Augustine argues that everything that is good and profitable in pagan society is to be found in the gifts of a good God. And so Augustine in Book 5 chronicles a bunch of things that were good about Roman society. But he said if you look at all these are to be owed to the providence of God. And so Augustine starts to teach what providence means. There's a difference between providence and fate. And this is something that most Christians in America don't understand, which is one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons why Reformed theology has such a difficult time in modern America is you confuse, in fact, very widely listened to radio talk show hosts who are apologists of sorts and whose names will not be mentioned, use the word fatalism to describe the view that Augustine held and Calvin. But there's two important differences. The one is personal, while the other is impersonal. So fatalism was more of a description of the way the stars were, and yes, they did exert causal power, but they exerted causal power over the gods, too. At the end of the day, even the gods were subject to fate. One's personal, one's impersonal. The other difference is that one is infinite and the other is finite. All of these gods that emerge at a certain point, that have limits and boundaries to what they know to do, what they can do in terms of their power, are finite. They're limited. So there's a huge difference between divine providence or God's total determinism, or put it this way, an infinite personal determinism, as opposed to an impersonal, finite determinism. So he said, do you guys believe in determinism? Yes, we do. We believe in an infinite person determining everything. And there's a huge difference. And only in this is freedom, by the way. Ask me after class. I'll explain to you how only in that view do you actually have freedom. So there's those two differences. Now, at this point of Augustine's life, he's only concerned to pit divine providence against the meaninglessness of pagan fatalism. He's not yet pitting this against any form of synergistic salvation. That'll come later in his anti-Pelagian writings. But he does, if you're wondering, in the City of God, there is actually quite a bit reconciling God's sovereignty and human responsibility, a total divine determinism, and the meaningfulness of our actions, primary causation, secondary causation. There's quite a bit on that in the City of God. But in this vein, Augustine takes on two theologies among the philosophical theologians of the empire. Because again, these philosophers of Rome understood that the Roman theology had to be wrong. And so they came up with two slightly more sophisticated ideas. One is that God is the soul of the world. And that was the view that was pretty much held by Cicero and by Varro. And then there was the idea that only rational animals, humans, are part of the one true God. And that's the view that was held by Seneca and the Stoics. In other words, human beings had the divine spark inside of them. Okay? And so they were actually parts of God. It was kind of rational pantheism, in a sense, the Stoics. But to both, Augustine could ask, well, then why is God angry at those who do not worship him, since these offenders are parts of himself? Now, it's different than asking the question that Nietzsche asked. Why is God angry at the pots that he's making in Romans 9? We'll show you that Nietzsche reads Romans 9 more than most Christians do. But anyway, he's a bad potter if he's just going to get angry and smash these things in the ground. Well, that's different because the clay is actually different than himself, and he has the right to do that. Whereas in these worldviews, Augustine's pointing to the fact that he would actually be smashing himself and angry at himself for not worshiping himself. There's no distinction between creator and creation, first cause and other causes. So it's irrational. But as I said, Varro wrote the definitive book on theology and religion among the Romans, and Augustine makes note of how he and all the smarter people thought it was impious to worship more God than one. So they admitted that. How they believed that God was the designer of the soul. Believe that. Yet without a soul himself. Yet at the same time with all the qualities that must belong to a soul. So Augustine's showing that the greatest Roman theologizers, on the one hand, were admitting all the things that you need to come to see that Christianity was the only true view, but at the end of the day, there were no theologians at all, because they wouldn't push through. Now that's our biggest section. But the reason is, if you have, I'm going to put up here, ultimate reference point. Every worldview has an ultimate reference. Every worldview attempts to have an ultimate reference point. You need it. You have to, psychologically, you have to have an ultimate reference point. Only Christianity has an actual, logically coherent, ultimate reference point. But here's the psychological problem. We'll show you logically why no other view will work. But ethically, Augustine's point is, no other view will work. Because if your ultimate reference point is, looks like an egg, doesn't it? Well, perfect then. It'll be cracked. If you have a cracked lens, everything you see is going to be cracked and in pieces, right? Okay? If you have a blurry lens, everything you look at is going to look blurry. It's like rose-colored glasses. If you have rose-colored glasses, everything's going to turn up red. Well, his point here, when he moves from his first section to the second section, is that your ultimate ethical reference points are going to be messed up. So you're going to have incoherent ethical norms. Incoherent, I'll just put incoherent, ethics. So what does your metaphysics or your theology or your ultimate presuppositions, how does it make or break society? How does it lead to the death of millions or resisting against those who would kill millions? Because what you believe in your presuppositions flows forth from the mind through the pen or the dictator's sword or Michelangelo's chisel, to use Schaeffer's language at the beginning of that book. But that's where Augustine's going in the early going. So here's the logic of all this demolition work of the city of God. He moves from incoherent ultimate reference point, and he shows that out of that comes the incoherence in the rest of one's vision. So even the closest guesses of the pagans in their virtue, even the closest approximations of pagan virtue to biblical definitions of godliness had this same basic problem. Do you remember what the problem with ultimate reference points were? They were particulars of nature. So you got a couple problems. Their effects. There was a time when they were not. They're mutable. They will not be again. Let's just start with that. Well, if that's your lens and it's cracked, what are you going to mean by words like beautiful or good or just and so forth? And so even in the closest approximations of pagan virtue, the best they did, it was always an exercise in cognitive dissonance. He says, first of all, we would ask the Romans why their gods took no steps to improve the morals of their worshippers. So these gods, as long as we're picking on them, why did they not send prophets, for example? And why didn't they warn the people? So in other words, there's two things you need, at least, for moral progress to occur among the people. And Augustine was sophisticated. He's not saying that these are the main things you need. The main things you need are up here. But let's just, on a practical level, there's two things you need for moral progress to occur among the people. You need a prophet, and you need a linear eschatology. In other words, you need both a warner and a warning of something of ultimate consequence. Now, a Roman could object that they had Cato or Cicero or whoever else as their prophets. But those guys had an eternal law that they weren't sure about. And they spoke about eternal realities that they lamented you could never prove. Hell for them was the loss of the Republic. But you couldn't get any higher than that. About their gods, the main one, now Augustine also uses the word Jove, and if you don't know, Jove and Jupiter are the same guy. Who was Zeus back here? Okay. But that's their father god. Now he's depicted as an adulterer. So the main thing you need to know about the father god, in their view, is that he's an adulterer. Well, that's a pretty good start. Well, if this is the father of all the greatest beings, what are you going to expect from the children? And the lesser neighbors? And the decadent plays were held to be commanded by the gods. So these weren't the people's choice, in their view. These are things that are commanded by the gods. So as one example, the perverted purification ceremony to the mother goddess, Cybele, where both men and women assembled, cultic prostitution going on everywhere, and Augustine says they could not for the very shame have rehearsed at home in the presence of their own mothers these same things. And yet this is the mother goddess that is being offered all these different sexual things. But the more indecent the ceremonial act, the more it propitiated the deities rather than offended them. And the whole of the syllogism, Augustine concluded, may be summed up in the following, or the whole of the discussion, be summed up in the following syllogism. This is an interesting way of looking at it. Augustine says, quote, "The Greeks give us the major premise. If such gods are to be worshipped, then certainly such men may be honored." So, let me draw this out. If such gods are to be worshipped, gods check. This is a hypothetical statement. Then such men check. That's what the Greeks gave to us. The Romans add the minor premise. But such men must by no means be worshipped. In other words, everybody agrees that if men acted like that, X, bad. And then Augustine said, the Christians draw the conclusion. Therefore, such gods must by no means be worshipped. And remember in the logic class, that was that second of the rules of inference, modus tollens, the way of negation. He's saying that what history is showing us now is a big, fat, modus tollens argument. And we Christians are just holding a mirror up to you and saying, okay, we agree with you about premise one, and we agree with you about premise two. And all we're doing is holding up a mirror and saying, yeah, you're right. And that's why society is going to hell, because it's one that your ideas have created. When the Roman objector claims that the philosophers will handle morality, not religionists, Augustine answers two things. First of all, that to hold a divine religion lower than one's human speculation is the surrender of the soul. In other words, if your revelation cannot afford to you anything higher than your own reasoning has attained at this point, then what does that even say about your reasoning? And he says the philosopher lacks both the power of public sanction, he can't enforce it, and the audience with the majority who are illiterate. Nobody reads their stuff anyway. And secondly, what philosophers? You Romans don't have any. They're all Greeks. And you threw them away. Now what about the four agreed upon classical virtues? There's four things that the classical mind believed about virtue. These are the four cardinal virtues. Prudence, justice, fortitude. It's kind of like their fruit of the Spirit, except it's their thing that man has in himself, and if you don't have these, your civilization will go down the tube, and certainly Augustine would agree that if you don't have these, your civilization will go down the tube. But again, what are these? Are they particulars that have no unity to them? You can call them whatever you want. But these are divisions of the gods, which are again divisions of nature. So the former problem up there in your ultimate reference point creates the latter. The basic trouble with not having a hierarchy in your ethics is that many things must remain ultimate. And that leads to many, many, many absurdities. So for Augustine offers some examples of the contrast. He says, quote, "In our ethics, we do not so much inquire whether a pious soul is angry as why he is angry. Not whether he is sad, but what is the cause of his sadness. Not whether he fears, but what he fears," end quote. There's some practical ethical distinctions there that I think, again, would correct not only the pagan, but shows you what Christian thinking is in a way that I think condemns a lot of the modern church. We don't think like that. We think when somebody, anger, bad. Ooh, mean. So we have regressed to a pagan animal thinking here. Where if you have a hierarchy of ethics, some things are bigger than other things, and therefore become the sun, in a sense, in the solar system, in the ethical solar system of those other things and passions that are happening, you have a standard to judge that's objective. If the philosophers had paid any attention to their craft, they would have recognized that ultimate reference points in nature force you to worship the most ultimate person that you can find, namely, or the most personal thing you can find, namely the state. He says, quote, "Thou desirest to worship the natural gods, thou art compelled to worship the civil." What Augustine's saying there is that if you reduce everything to the most natural thing, you still have an immaterial longing in your soul, and therefore the things that are most personal, that rise to the top, you will be tempted to worship. And so if you insist on worshiping impersonal forces as your ultimate reference point, you will not be able to resist eventually turning to the thing that gets the most amount done, that acts more like a mover upon these things. And so I think that's a good insight. Now, at the end of all this, Augustine says that the Platonists, the followers of Plato, come the closest to the truth. And Calvin would say something somewhat similar in the Institutes. But Augustine would say this about them, pointing to the invisible and the immaterial realm that they talked about. The invisible, the eternal, according to Plato and the Platonists, is the source of good and therefore the solace of the soul. The whole point of life is to be pointing your immaterial part, the most excellent part of your being, namely your soul, your intellect, at those objects that are proper to the soul. And in so conceiving of the highest things, the followers of Plato prepared the mind, at least, to conceive of God more accurately than many professing Christians have done. Quote, "They have seen that whatever is changeable is not the Most High God. Whatever else is can only be through Him who truly is, because He is unchangeable." End quote. And for that reason, Augustine says, if one is nearer to God, and he's saying this about the Platonic insight, they had enough sense to know that if one is nearer to God, the liker he is to Him. There is no other distance from God than unlikeness to Him. And the soul of man is unlike that incorporeal and unchangeable and eternal essence in proportion as it craves things temporal and mutable. And that's the point where Cicero would really take after Plato. You are never less like God and therefore less eternal and more susceptible. The further you fall away from the eternal law, the more disordered you are and the more susceptible you are to the order of the state. It's like that old thing we try to teach our children all the time. You will either be ordered from within or you will be beaten from without. Someone will want to impose order on you. If you act like that out there, you will be savagely beaten and thrown away in a jail. Why? Because you have no order. That's not me trying to enforce my will on you. I'm just telling you that if you don't have order from within, it will be imposed from without. And so Augustine was saying Plato and their followers really give us the key to how that works. To be thinking about the eternal is going to make your soul more like the eternal. More unchanging, more steady, more like an oak and less like a reed shaken in the wind. But he did not have unqualified admiration for the Platonists, because their best adherents, in down close to his day, in the century before, a guy named Plotinus and another guy named Porphyry, were exposed to Christian doctrine in the 3rd century, so a century leading up to Augustine. And they saw something about the plurality of personhood in the Godhead. So think about this. Arius in Alexandria, and Athanasius too, so 80 years before Augustine, and then before them, Origen, and then Clement of Alexandria, the Alexandrian school, they were rubbing shoulders with these Neoplatonists. The Neoplatonists had interaction with Christian ideas. And apparently, Plotinus and others saw a kind of plurality in the Godhead, with the Logos being the mind of God, and then there being a passion as well. And they saw that. Yet they rejected the incarnation due to their error about the divine not being able to inhabit the flesh. And that's where Gnosticism comes from right there. But Augustine's point is, what arrogant and ironic nonsense. You would have the finite soul of a man be able to achieve reunification with the divine, but you deny the abilities of the infinite power of God to achieve a unification with the flesh of man. And so in your view, the two can go together after all, so long as it is man who achieves it. So again, these are the best thinkers who are not Christian, that Augustine is exposing the irrationality of their belief. Now, the chief Roman virtue, the chief part of their ethics, the one that characterized the civilization, was glory. But Augustine notes that what this comes to mean is nothing other than global totalitarianism. And he says that such a kingdom is nothing but a large robbery, and a robbery nothing but a small such kingdom. He says, glory they most ardently loved. For it they wished to live. For it they did not hesitate to die. Every other desire was repressed by the strength of their passion for that one thing. He also described this Roman glory as, quote, eagerness for praise and the display of their valor. And at that time it was their greatest ambition, he says, either to die bravely or to live free. You say, oh, that sounds American, that sounds good. But, he says, when liberty was obtained, so great a desire for glory took possession of them that liberty alone was not enough unless domination also should be sought, end quote. In Augustine's mind, glory seeking itself is not the problem. Augustine insisted, quote, for glory, honor, and power are desired alike by the good man and by the ignoble. Yet the false glory seeker is made by false worship, as the Romans worship the gifts of virtue rather than their giver. Augustine said, for the glory, with the desire of which the Romans burned, is the judgment of men thinking well of them. And when I thought of that, when I read that quote, I thought immediately of John 5:44, where Jesus said, how can you receive true glory, in a sense, when you receive glory from one another? In other words, he's saying the two things are incompatible. The love of praise. Now, here's what Augustine says about that. God used that. He's still using it. The love of praise from others, though a vice, appears in its day as a virtue, because it restrains more savage virtues for a time. Though the mere Roman was a time-bound pagan and could not see above the times, God used their false glory-seeking to stave away the barbarians for a time, for his own purposes. And at the end of the day, the beings truly being worshipped in the form of these deities were demons, as Augustine suggests, unless the truth be that they fled from Troy because they were vanquished and betook themselves to Rome to practice their characteristic deceptions there. They are flatterers of the fortunate. So in other words, the demons move in history. They get the word that history is moving that way, from Troy as the center stage to Rome as the center stage. And so they flow in that direction, and they flatter the fortunate. Well, if books 1 through 5 show the inability of the Roman gods to deliver the kingdom on earth or to preserve happiness in this life, books 6 through 10 show that they could do even worse for you in the life to come. And so, last section, incoherence proven by their own authors and by history. And this is where Augustine turns to evidential apologetics. Moves from philosophical ground clearing to evidence, to show the truth showing up even in their authors. And in some ways, Rome is going to suffer the same fate as every merely secular organism there could ever be. And it's going to suffer the fate that I call, Augustine didn't use this word, but I think it's a good term to show what he was talking about, cultural entropy. And you know what entropy is, right? The loss of available heat energy. In other words, the disorganization of information. So, what creates human life and collective human life is a signal. In other words, a coherent picture and command that comes with it, where you have being and not being. This is what computer programmers do. But it's what all human civilizations do. And in fact, it mirrors the intelligent design that created the cosmos to begin with. Well, as people become bored looking at eternal objects because they're hyped up on video games and strung out on reality TV shows, they grow a distaste. It's like eating Pop Rocks before you get to the steakhouse. It's like watching Saturday Night Live Saturday and on Sunday morning you're when preaching. Because you're full on cotton candy. You can't digest the real thing anymore. Well, as that happens and you become exhausted with true glory seeking, you're still a glory seeking being. But you'll turn to the images and the shadows and the created things rather than the Creator. And when that happens, the organization of information, the solidity of human thoughts that empty out on the stage of history and protect and defend and build and move and are good for people starts to wither out. And a new civilization that has a faith, it could be completely irrational by comparison, but if they're on the way up, never mind that they're going to shrink wrap your daughters in burqa and put you in a swastika cover lampshade, never mind that, they want to return everything to the Stone Ages. In that one respect, they're actually acting more like men than you are. Well, then they will win. 50 years, 500 years, I don't know, but they'll win. Well, the opposite of that is cultural entropy. And that's what he saw. And so he says, all the way from the beginning of Rome, opulence gave birth to envy and the vice of restless ambition were the political parents of Rome. Augustine's own command of Roman history is made plain by tracing it back to the successors of the mythical Romulus, a city founded in bloodshed, moving from one false peace after another to appease their guilt. And the climax of Roman glory must have been the victory against Carthage in the Punic Wars. And yet at that very moment, the Republic was starting to slip right in there, in that 3rd to 2nd century before Christ. And at that very moment, what happened? Rome became, from the next big power along with Carthage, growing with them, Immediately overnight, all of this was theirs. And what happened is what sociologists call the vertical invasion of the barbarians, which didn't mean physical barbarians shaking the gate, but it meant a humongous demand of people to govern and not enough supply of traditional culture to soak them up. In other words, a glut of people flooding onto the historic stage that there is not enough cultural organization to organize their minds and build their souls. And you don't have the capacity to prepare them for liberty and for order. Now there's plenty of bloody civil wars before the coming of Christ. Most famously that between Julius Caesar and Pompey, and then after that between Octavian and Mark Antony, that put to death what was left of the Republic and consequently sentenced Roman civilization to its inevitable demise, all before Jesus ever came into the world. So what are we doing blaming Christians? The Roman poets and dramatists support Augustine's thesis. The poets do it in two ways. First of all, by their silence. It was a forced silence, because the Senate, and then Caesar, made it a capital crime to represent any of them at all. You could not, in a play, speak badly about a Roman citizen, much less a Roman public official. But you could portray a god as if he were a giant baby with no self-control. To represent their ultimate reference points as neurotic, murdering thugs and rapists. Now perhaps, Augustine says, not only did demons speak through the poets themselves, but as demons under the control of God's providence, many of their words were used unwittingly, like Caiaphas, to prophesy. He says, the poets, therefore, when they composed and sang these things about the conquered gods, had no intention to invent falsehoods, but uttered as honest men what the truth extorted from them. But truth or not, in the main, he says, by gradually creeping in through the souls of men, the poets were seduced, and by them the people were seduced. The Roman philosophers and civic commentators support Augustine's thesis. According to Cicero, a society that features suicidal art has already blown away its soul. By the way, this was the Founding Father's point. When John Adams said things, for example, like, this constitution is only suitable for a moral people, he was not talking about government reforming the people's soul, or government telling people how to behave morally. He was telling us what Benjamin Franklin apparently told that woman when he came out of Independence Hall, and she said, "Sir, what have you given us?" And he said, "A republic, ma'am, if you can keep it." In other words, if you can keep your pants on. Libertarians, love libertarians, I am one, but apparently don't understand when the Founding Fathers and when the classical philosophers talk about this, they think they're hearing something about government grabbing your heart and making you nice and creating beauty and virtue and so forth. Well, that may be what a lot of people have in their mind. That's not what these guys are talking about. They're telling us what we hopefully tell our children. You will either be ordered from without, or somebody will beat you with a billy club and throw you into a concentration camp. That, those are your only two choices. If you can't control yourself, you will have a swastika on your arm in 30 years. Period. That's the main thing you need to know. And so therefore, Cicero talks about the arts. He says, quote, "The lewdness of comedy could never have been suffered by audiences unless the customs of society had previously sanctioned the same lewdness." In other words, garbage in, garbage out. Like people, like Hollywood reality TV shows. So they are real in one sense. It's what we crave. Moreover, Cicero said about the origin of all this, that Homer invented these things and transferred things human to the gods. I would rather transfer things divine to us. That's why Plato wanted to round up all the poets. And Augustine wasn't saying, I agree with him about that, but he was saying, they're right in that insight. There is, you cannot have both. You cannot have Hollywood and liberty. You can't have both. You're not strong enough. You're little humans. Your sex drive, your desire for blinking images, your animals to the degree that you don't look at eternal objects. You can't have both. One of them's got to go. The Roman historians support Augustine's thesis. The writings of Sallust and Caesar's Gallic Wars are quoted to show how all of the approved executions and unqualified desecration by pagan armies of life, liberty, and property of the conquered, that was the norm. Christians had changed that. So the argument is opposite of the truth. The history of Roman society came to this, that while all the major cities of the Mediterranean were now under barbarian flags, with only these remote towns of northern Africa remaining, the last holdouts, the masses were oblivious and as decadent as they could possibly be. He says, how is it that while, as we hear, even the eastern nations are bewailing your ruin, and while powerful states in the most remote parts of the earth are mourning your fall as a public calamity, you yourselves should be crowding to the theaters, should be pouring into them, filling them, and in short, playing a madder part now than ever before. I remember last week's history class. I'll close with this. I'll do the gospel call next week that Augustine gives. Last week's history class, I read basically a catalog, two pages, of all the different persecutions of the various Nero's persecution, Domitian's persecution, the one under Marcus Aurelius, and then under Diocletian. The famous persecutions, some chronicled by the Fox's Book of Martyrs, but any good church history, and I just collected all these sentences, and I left no breathing room for any talk of anything other than the methods of execution. And I just did that for about 10 minutes. They bashed out their fingers, they did this to their jaw, then they threw them on the fire, and then when the fire was enough, they threw them against the cliff, and then the bamboo shot through their thing, and then they drawn and quartered, and then they did this, and they took this baby from her mother, chopped up her face, knife in the eye, taking out the face, and the kids were like, "Argh." And at one point, nervous laughter, they laughed. They didn't know what else to do. And at the end of it, Mariah's like, "Where's this happening?" I said, "Oh, it's happening right now in Europe. The Muslims are coming. You know, it's part of Sharia law. Preferably with a hacksaw. And now self-hating Europeans are now voting on whether or not they want to have their heads chopped off." "What do you mean, where is it now?" And she asked again, "Where is this happening now?" I said, "No, that's what they're doing now. That's what they're doing, but for people thinking about the eternal law and holding it out. If you don't know that, if that's not the air you breathe, I love you, you can get on the train, but you can't be on the engine. You can't drive the steering wheel." And that's why we have the school, so that you guys will fight them. Now go play football at recess.
And I'll just say amen, because I've been in Afghanistan and I've seen it.
Yeah.
And I know it happens.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, it's human. It's the norm.
We had just as many kids come in with the same issues as soldiers. Because they're doing it to their own kids. So,
yeah. It's the norm in human history. That's the norm in the fall. Apart from Christ, apart from the order that human beings are called, you say, well, that's not the gospel. I know that's what we're going to open off with next week. There is a last part where Augustine weaves throughout all this an invitation to come join us. Not in some secular city that we're going to build and dominate and have another version of that. That wasn't Augustine's claim. But he said, come to join us in this thing, and this thing is what we're going to draw out for the next 3 weeks, this thing called the City of God. So, with that, open up to questions, comments, anything. Anything you got? Yep.
The ultimate problem Augustine was saying was that they had incoherent ultimate reference points.
Yeah.
And I think it could be tempting for Christians to say, well, we have a singular ultimate reference point, but in modern Christianity, is it coherent or not?
Right. If this winds up being a reflection of one or several of these rather than the other way around, because these things are meant to display the glory of God, but if this thing winds up meaning being caused by these things, in other words, this thing is what it is because this thing is what it is, if the eternal is a mirror of the temporal, that's not God either. And you've moved the problem up one step, which was Plato's ultimate problem in Book 6 of the Republic, but in practical life we do that. I can just think of one example off the top of my head. Love. God is loving. If God is loving, he must, finish the sentence. And usually the end of that sentence will be something down here. Well, love looks like that here, or I expect this, or a loving person would do such and such, and you make the first cause caused by one of the second causes, which is irrational and causes all sorts of problems and is blasphemous, because you're saying about God that he ought to be more like something that he's made. Yeah, yeah.
Difference being noted that fatalism is finite and impersonal, but I want to focus in specifically on it being finite.
Okay.
In what way, other than the being directing the providence, is the providence infinite?
What was the last word? Sorry. In what way?
Other than the being who is directing the providence, how is the providence in of itself infinite?
Oh, because as God is infinite, in this case, all of his attributes are infinite, so his goodness will be an infinite goodness, his justice will be an infinite justice, and let's just take his wisdom, what he knows he ought to do, both to sustain his own glory, and to cause all secondary causes in a way that glorifies himself. There's no limitation for him on any of these. So he'll never run out of knowledge, for example, of how to ordain all the different things in a way that ever threatens him or in a way that defames him. Whereas if you're finite in these things, you're not aware of what will sustain your own being. Some other god or being or thing could in some way thwart your will or perhaps bring harm to you or defame your glory in some sense. And so there's a limitation on your part to how to execute all the secondary causes.
Oh, okay. So I think I understand. So in essence, the difference is fatalism is not being guided by infinite goodness or infinite justice or anything.
Right. And here's the other thing, too. Remember, all the gods are below this. So their reference point is this as well. You say, well, maybe the thing that's guiding them is infinite. But not knowing that, you still have the same basic problem. Okay? Now, Augustine would say, in a weird sort of perverted way, you're right. The thing that is governing these things that you think are ultimate actually is ultimate. And we would say that that is God, who is infinitely ordaining all these things. Not for your good, though, because they would say to Zeus that that's really a demon, or perhaps a demon has inspired the poet's imagination or something. But you know, all, no matter how many steps you move up, the same problem remains. Either that cause of all things is infinite or else finite. And that does wonders for the whole freedom discussion as well, too, which I think Augustine does talk about later. In fact, that's where we'll start next week. So we'll get to the divine sovereignty and providence versus supposedly the free and meaningful actions of the creature.